Campus FM presents excerpts from part two of the extraordinary meeting of the Group 3 Bureau of the European Economic and Social Committee. The meeting was titled The Role and Involvement of Various Civil Society Players in Achieving a Balance Between the Three Pillars of the Lisbon Strategy.
Mr. Bingley, I met you in Budapest at an event, and at that event there was a discussion with a representative of what was DG5 at the time, and there that person from the Commission said that all of the organisations at the event, or none of them, were independent because they depended on funding from the Commission. And none of them actually dared to take up a contrary position to that. I mean, it's important to remember that the Commission is obliged to provide funding for those organisations, and you have to therefore distinguish between funding, independence on funding, on independence when it comes to the content of the work which is done. It's therefore very important for me that these criteria should be drafted and set down. We need to have these criteria applicable to quality and quantity, though criteria for quality will be more difficult to draw up. Now, I don't necessarily fully agree with Jan Olsen. He says that it'd be possible to prove that you have qualitative representativeness by showing that one has already worked frequently together with the Commission. Because if you take that tack, then the risk is that you're going to create a closed shop. It's almost against the spirit of developing civil society, because you're closing in on what can be done. It would mean that a lot of organisations will not be able to work together with the Commission in the future if they haven't done so in the past. So there are a whole range of things which we have to think through and to bring together. You can identify all these different criteria, but you've got to work out how they fit together. And that's the framework within which we want to work. And then there's another thing which I think is very important when it comes to the Commission. The Commission has said that a lot of what we're doing now is theoretical, and that there have been contacts in the past. Now, I think that there is a distinction which has to be drawn. You have to distinguish between consultation and participation. Consultation is a top-down process. The Commission decides which partners it wishes to talk with. Other criteria are applied in that sort of situation. It's quite possible that people are identified who are then not particularly representative, but they do have a great deal of expertise in particular areas. Now, then on the other hand, you have participation, which is another process, and this can only be a bottom-up process. It's something which can only come up from the grassroots level and move upwards and receive recognition from the state level. And I think that that is something which is very important for all future discussions. This distinction must be drawn, because this wasn't clear in the constitutional treaty either. It says the institutions will engage in dialogue with different organisations and consult them. But that's not civil dialogue for us. Civil dialogue for us comes from the bottom upwards and feeds into dialogue which has to be structured. Now, that's all been very theoretical. The question which arises now is that who's going to certify all of this? Who's going to monitor it? And again, I don't think the Commission can be the one to do that. It cannot be a body which is outside the process which can take this decision. It's not just because I'm a member of the EESC that I say this, but I think that the EESC is the only body that can do that. There are two reasons for this. We are an institution, but not on the same footing as the Commission, the Council, etc. We're on a halfway house site footing. We are more of a bridge towards citizens. And in the committee, we have representatives of those people affected by the work which is done. We have representatives of civil society in there. And without those people involved in the process cannot take place. So I'm going to do my best to ensure that a group which we set up 2 years ago, a contact group with a major European organisation, that we find some sort of way of undertaking certification as a first step. I think it would be good for everyone if we can do that. It will help individuals who are just getting up and running. If they have these criteria, they know that they have to fulfil them to participate in the procedure, but also it will help them to be fully transparent. Dialogue has to work. We have to be able to deal with subjects as early as possible, not everyone working on their own, but we have to consult and cooperate with one another as much as possible. I'm aware that this is really very much at the inception, and we've got a long road in front of us, and I hope that next time we come back together, we're able to put some more flesh on these bones. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. And we have to start exchange of view. First, I will say that what I understand is that we have got the member of the European Parliament from Maltese and Mr. Doctor Simon Borch and Basadil, yes. It's a learning process. It's a lifelong learning process. But we are happy that you are here. And if you want to intervene and if you want to exchange, you are, of course, welcome to take the floor. But yes, please.
Edwin Kaleya, member of the ESC representing employers. It was very interesting to hear Madam Sigmund and her vision about the representativeness of civil society. One remark about the Constitution, which is important, I believe, in this respect, which you mentioned earlier on in your presentation. To consider the European Constitution as dead would mean that we are forgetting all about the Rome Treaty and the other amendments to it, including the Maastricht, Amsterdam Treaties, and the rest, that have now been included in the new European Constitution. So it doesn't make sense at all to say that the Constitution is dead, because we're simply writing off the past of this union, European Union, that has been constructed painstakingly throughout these past almost 50 years. So we need to revive the European Constitution, I agree with you, and we need to ensure that Europe is closer to the citizen, and that every European citizen must be convinced that of the unity of purpose, of the unity of vision, of the economic, social, and environmental goals and problems, and that we should be sharing ideas, and we should be ultimately sharing even the goals that we are aiming for and how to go about them. And in fact, I believe the topic of this morning's discussion we have, the Lisbon Agenda, is a proof of this. We are not really. We have been talking about the Lisbon Agenda 5 years on, and still we haven't got down to action. And I would be reflecting what our younger representative from ESC here from the Czech Republic mentioned, that younger people are really impatient to see action being taken. Everyone should believe in common action, though this might differentiate the magnitude and emphasis. This would unify our efforts and create synergies across all the countries of Europe. This is what constitutes a union, which we need to be proud of. And every citizen of Europe should be proud of belonging to this union. It was interesting to hear from you, Madam President, about the question of representativeness. And in this regard, I would say that it is important that unions, employers, organizations, and civil society will have the credentials of strong representation. As you say, Mrs. Sigmund, the bottom-up approach is important, and it has to work satisfactorily through the strength that our opinions in the institutions of Europe, in the Economic and Social Committee, in the Parliament, would be really reflecting what the citizen is feeling. And the stronger the organizations of civil society and the representativeness of them would obviously reflect in the bottom-up feedback that you would be getting, and obviously they would be part of the solutions, they would be part of the goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Mr. Steffens.
Thank you very much for that very clear summary presentation. It was very clear indeed. I don't want to contribute to the discussion, but I just have three questions I'd like to raise to ensure that I've understood properly. When you had your 9 criteria, I can accept most of them without further ado. Most of them do have to be fleshed out and made more operational, but you've said that yourself. But I have a problem with the criteria that the principle of the voluntary nature of the organisations is missing. Now, I know what it means. Everything which were made mandatory, and here I'm thinking about professional associations and many other associations too, well, these would actually fall through the net of civil society, because there's a lot of legislation applicable to them, meaning that they have to become organisations, associations, they have to pay fees as well. Now, a lot's going on at the European level, and a lot of what happens at European level also affects the national level. National level, we have to deal with the question of representativeness as well. And this is something which would be important in helping us to resolve the ongoing problem which we have when it comes to qualitative representativeness, i.e. that all parliamentarians, all governments say that if you have an organisation which has been set up, if that organisation could fund itself, then it would be dependent of all funding from national governments and the EU, and that would mean that the organisation would then be independent, and that would be quality in representativeness for me. Third point, obviously the European umbrella organisations also already have rules of their own when it comes to membership of national organisations. There are certain principles of exclusion there, all related to the question of independence which you were talking about. But this is a problem which needs to be dealt with in a fairly flexible way if you have these strict criteria for exclusion. There's just one thing I wanted to point out. We've been talking about the EU and independence from the Commission. I think really we're focusing our attention too greatly on the EU level there. We're not just talking about EU funding, but there are also funds available from the member states, and that funding has to be approved by parliaments, because parliaments have the right to adopt budgets. Parliaments do that every 1 or 2 years, and if a parliament decides to make funding for a particular organisation, then it means that the parliament is recognising the work of that organisation. That's one thing. But the other thing is also, in principle, recipients can in principle be audited by courts of auditors to ensure that they are working in the correct fashion. This is very important, but it's something which shouldn't be brushed away when we talk about independence. You were talking about freedom from instructions, and that this is something which is quite different from independence when it comes to the content of work. Those are the points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Mr. Stephens, yes, the floor is still yours. It's only task. Mal Hallam.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your very detailed presentation on very burning issue on representativeness and communication on EU in member states and on European level. I would say that the national government should have the bigger responsibility in involving people in discussions, in communication on EU issues. Even in this morning, some people noticed that if something goes wrong, then everybody's blaming Brussels. If something goes well, then the governments usually say that we did it. And this is very symbolic, and this is very usual, I think, in every member state. Now, the EC and us in the member states should make a bigger pressure on our governments to really have a real European policy and make this policy together with civil society, with NGOs, with target groups and representative bodies. Interestingly, it's not popular, but we have to change it. If we look around the people who have written recently about Europe, the Americans, you look at the book of Jeremy Rifkin, European Dream. If you read it, you become a real European fan, but why these two thoughts should come from the States? And we cannot show any of such a bestseller from Europe, what everybody would knew and really would like. So let's look at the simple things and see and make them clear to our people. We in Estonia are going to translate this book, and not because of we are big fans of Jeremy Rifkin, but because we would like to have a real discussion on pros and cons, on advantages and the situation in the world comparing to Europe. And finally, we see that Europe is a very good place to live in, and the European Union is not so bad. And coming back to the constitutional treaty, I think that this is not a problem of the text of treaty. Not majority of people haven't read this text, of course, but this is a problem of communication again. French people, it's my opinion, and Dutch people were afraid of enlargement, of Polish plumber, of cheap labor force, and not they were not voting for the text of the constitutional treaty, which is really simple and not very complicated. So the national government should speak to people about the issues and to really discuss the policies in the very beginning stage of new ideas on the level of European Union. And unfortunately, in Estonia, I can see that the EU, the questions of EU are coming down to funds, to structural funds, cohesion funds, to money and not to values. This is another thing what the governments and civil society should do together, really speak about the values and why we are working together, why it's important, not only because we don't want a war anymore, but there is something more on the agenda, values, and not only structural funds. So national governments and working together and being involved in not only preparing the national policies, but together national and European policies. Hopefully we will talk more about that in November, on 7th and 8th November, how to do that. There are several ways, methods and ideas, and some countries have very good experiences how to do that, what are those mechanisms. But hopefully, if we can provide some good ideas to our governments, to EU institutions, to our civil society groups, then we can change make a difference and change the situation. Before the enlargement or the joining the EU, one Estonian writer wrote that Estonia is ready for EU as a state, but not as a society. At the moment, I think that lots of old member states had the same situation. The governments were in, but people didn't know too much about that. So let's make a difference. Thank you.
Mal Helm, thank you very much for an excellent intervention. But you mentioned also the 7th of 8th of November. I'm quite sure Anne-Marie will come back and explain what we are inviting to in Brussels to all of the non-government organizations in the member states. On my list, I have Miklos, I have Lady back, and I have Man back, and I have Stulik, I have Le Scornet, or Mrs. Attard. So still we have to go on with discussion. Yeah, it's your first.
Thank you, Stefan. If we take someone who is listening to this discussion, one conclusion what you might, this person might easily draw, that there is total confusion. There is total confusion on the European level. People are speaking on different topics, having different approaches. What will come out of it? This is the question. My reaction to such a, let me say, theoretical question is that this is a very promising situation for us. Promising in the sense that whether we like or not, mainly due to the failure of the French and Dutch referendum, we arrived to a situation when the professional politicians, those who are the former decision makers, failed, which is, by the way, a painful and unfortunate development. But let's look at the situation from a positive perspective. And the discussion what we are having today and here in Malta and in several other places is an encouraging discussion. Encouraging in the sense that if, I would say, the selected few failed, then there is a vacuum and we can come in. Because after all, the selected few are just or should not play this so-called political game for themselves, but there should be a combined efforts of society. And this is why I would like to refer also what Tuma mentioned, that we have to come into the picture. Partly when I say we, of course you can put immediately the question referring to what Anne-Marie referred to. What is this we, or who are this we? I think that this is also a very interesting question, and I don't want to go here into details, but for me the important thing is that we need this type of discussion, what we are having here in Malta. We need a lot of this discussion all over Europe in order to prove the maturity of the people on whose behalf otherwise the selected few are taking the decision, that we would like to have our own share. Because for me, the lesson of the situation is that no matter whether you are a president of a republic, you are a prime minister, or you are a member of the European Parliament or whatever, alone you will fail. It's only a question of time. You need a kind of public support. And this is where we as civil society organizations can come into the picture. The other thing is what I think is important for us in that respect is that how to combine the national and the European level. And it's interesting, if you look at the various documents of the European Commission, let's say during the last 8 to 10 years, there is one common element in the different communications or in the different documents, namely that the Commission was wise enough to recognize that civil society in Europe is very diverse, which is a value in itself. Consequently, Brussels took the what I would call wise decision to respect and leave this variety of civil society organizations as it is, encouraging certain basic conditions how to develop, but otherwise respecting. And you don't have to be a scholar to discover that how civil society is organized in Malta, it is absolutely different how civil society, as we learned, is organized, even how it is named in Sweden. And it's good. But there are obviously some common elements, and this is what we try to somehow bring together. It's a difficult task, how to bring together these different national considerations and elements on the European level. Just to illustrate, this morning we had a very good presentation here on the Youth Council in Malta. Don't forget, it was mentioned that they have close to 40 member organizations. In order to come to some kind of agreement, it means that under normal circumstances, You have to, well, to summarize somehow the position of this 40, and it is still only the Maltese Youth Council. And what happens is, under normal circumstances, that the representative of the Maltese Youth Council go to Brussels and attend the meeting of the European the European body. Then he is only one of the actors. And if they manage to put somehow a position together, it can be already very far from an individual local organization. So, and to make things even more complicated, that this European Youth Council is sitting to, or is having a dialogue with our committee, the Economic and Social Committee, trying to put together something what can influence the whole process. With this, I simply wanted to indicate that it is a rather complicated process, and the kind of expertise is, whether you like or not, needed. So it becomes also a kind of profession to understand on one hand, but we have to be very careful that those so-called professionals should be still part of the process. So consequently, the guy from Malta who goes to Brussels and participates in this debate, when he comes back, should report back to the organizations. And I mean, this is the process. And my concluding word in that respect is that that is the European Economic and Social Committee, I mean our body. And there are Maltese, there are participants and full participants in that body. It's very important how they participate there in their individual capacity in the formal sense of the word. But it is very important what message they take from Malta to Brussels or to our meeting. And equally important what message, or if there is a kind of conclusion on a certain debate, how it is taken back to Malta and how these experiences, these messages are shared with the other and disseminated. We are in the learning process, and let me say it also as a Hungarian that for me and the four civil society representatives who are sitting in this group three, it's a big challenge how to have this permanent communication. In Brussels, we are receiving tons of papers on most diverse issues, how to consult, how to collect opinions, how to, and so on and so forth. Just a small thing that we decided to have our own website in order to make this link more active, more productive, more living with Hungarian civil society organization. I think that this is, generally speaking, a challenge to civil society organizations, to politicians, but I think that with the type of debate what we are having here today, we can be quite optimistic that we can we can put forward certain concrete proposals which will lead Europe out of the seemingly deadlock situation created basically by politicians. Thank you.
Thank you, Miklos. I think we have at least 10 to 15 minutes still, and we can take the time we need, but I'm a little afraid that the family of Mr. Scicluna, they are waiting and waiting, and the food will be cold and everything will be destroyed. So if you need to leave, you have to leave.
Thank you so much.
Then we thank you very much, and we are old friends, but we give you a thank you very much for our opportunity.
Thank you.
I hope your family will accept our excuse, yes, for using you today.
Yes, they're all understanding. The cats won't understand, though. They won't do it. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now on the list I have, first I have Seppo Kallio, then I have ladies back here, if I take it in the right order, but Seppo Kallio.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you very much for Mrs. Sigmund. Your presentation was really very, very good and very large. Also, I would like to say first that this is naturally a very difficult item to analyze due to the fact that if you look at the role of the civil society or representatives in different countries and EU, it's so that we have so different circumstances in the different societies. But I would like to start from the role of the civil society organizations, that first of all, that they are working on a democratic basis. And I think that on the national level, generally speaking, it's very relatively clear that the national government or parliament gives the certain kind of a legislative framework how the organization are working. It's very clear. But naturally, it's different if we compare the old EU members and the new one. It's a little bit, the history is a little bit different. And for example, my country, my organization, Finnish Farmers Union, is 90 years old organization, and my sister organization, the cooperative organization, it is 106 years old, which means that this history is relatively old. And I would like to say so that also it's my feeling that the organization are working, I would like to say so that we are relatively satisfied how the Finnish government or our political leaders are working with organizations. But I have worked in my ESA capacity in, for example, Bulgarian accession process for 7-8 years. And I have made also some analysis in that work how the civil society organization are working in Bulgaria circumstances. And I must say so that naturally it's a some very fundamental disadvantage or difference due to the fact that some organization really they have the problem to work, as actually Mr. Stephens very clearly said, that the very important point that the organizations are independent. If they are not, if they are some kind of part of the political regime, then it's very difficult to work in the consistent or confidence way. And in the EU level, Economic and Social Committee naturally has the clear role, and also NICE Treaty gave a little bit more mandate for us. But my feeling is that also on the European Union level, it's a very clear lack of the certain type of representatives, how the organizations, civil society organization can work. And I take one example. Mr. Lamy, the WTO General Director, ex-Trade Commissioner, he started this civil society process in the trade policy area, which was very fundamental matter on the EU level, because really it's so that a commission traditionally has been relatively closed body. Naturally, if the interest organization have been very well organized and they have worked actively for the commission, it has had certain possibility to influence and to cooperate. But that the whole trade policies on the open forum, it's the new step in this transparent in the EU level. Therefore, I appreciate this process very much. But really, I would like to say my conclusion is that on the EU level, it's a lot of work which ought to be done, but
mobile off.
Okay, I don't know who is it. Which one is it? Okay, and I would like to add that this debate it's necessary, and I would like to say so that we in the Economic and Social Committee and also on the national level, different organizations, we are not too active. We must be more active, and we must try to advance or to continue this debate everywhere when we are working. It's so that it's a lack of information anyway, very much in the European Union level and also on national level. You can see very high official on the EU level who really don't know what is the Economic and Social Committee, which is it's really understand. I cannot understand at all. But I have met many people who are on the very height of person, but they don't know what is the role of ESE. It's that. but it's important. We must encourage this open debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Seppo Kallio. And coming back to this noise you hear, it's coming from Bombay, and Seppo come from Suomi, Finland. I think it's only Nokia who make this noise. I think Sony Ericsson is quiet. Now, I will take the responsibility as president and give priority to speakers from the invited guests from Altesian side. And first we have, and give us some sorts of priority. First, I have ladies in my front, please.
I would like to make a reflection on two about the elderly. In all European countries, we're fully aware that the number of elderly citizens is increasing. This is a phenomenon, and it's wonderful to be that. Even looking around here in this room, I noticed that quite a few of members present are 60 plus. This morning, when I was listening to the three young, eloquent speakers we had, I could sense that there was an underlying fear they had about us, the elderly. I can reassure them that they don't need to be afraid of that at all, because the elderly are a resource in any society. They have the richesse of experience. They can contribute to the economic growth and social development of their country, and they have an important role to play. So they needn't be afraid at all. This morning I also listened about the role of women. May I perhaps say that one of the happiest roles of a woman is motherhood. And whilst it is important for us all to reflect about the need of enhancing our economic growth and employment, we mustn't forget that the family, as an important cell in society, has a lot to contribute. It contributes in the happiness of the people. And if only we were to bear in mind this, then perhaps some of the things that are a source of distress to us, seeing that there is a growing imbalance between the child population and the elderly population, may balance itself in a very natural manner. I was rather distressed when the gentleman sitting by my side this morning, Mr. John Bencini, the president of the Teachers Union, was telling me that this year there are 12 primary schools in Malta that are closing down because of a decreasing population. I think this is a very sad thing. And this is food for thought, I feel, for us all here.
Thank you very much indeed. I have a lady also back. Yes, first. Yes, lady back. Not black, but back.
Claudia Taylor East. We speak about common principles, and we also speak about participation of citizens. First of all, I'd like to say that we're in the unhappy situation here for NGOs, that we don't have a legal identity. We still have no legal framework. Plus, we speak about independence. I'd like you, perhaps, Mrs. Sigmund, to elaborate on the independence of the non-governmental sector at national level, not only at EU level.
Thank you very much. I have, blue man.
Good afternoon. It's Michael Greg from the Goldberg Business Chamber. for our guests today. Maybe they have not heard of Gozo. Gozo is the second island of Malta with a population of nearly 30,000 people. I wanted to put a couple of questions to Frau Sigmund. First of all, I wanted to ask if the EU insists that the voice of the civil society coming from the smaller regions of the EU is heard within the EESC. Secondly, if this is so, what are the safeguards which the EESC takes when it comes to making sure that the voice of these minority civil society organizations are being actually heard within the EESC? Thank you.
Now we have the man from the elderly, and then I will give that to the speaker from the European Parliament.
Hello, it's Carmen Maglia again. We all know now that the European Treaty has given prominence and importance to the civil society. And here I have a pamphlet issued by the European Foundation for the Improvement of Living and Working Conditions, Changing Europe, Better Work and Better Life. And I know that this foundation has laid out a program, four-year program, between 2005 and 2008. And it has come to my knowledge that the foundation is formed up only of the social partner and public authority, and NGO are not included. So it is a bit conflicting. We all recognize the importance of civil society, and these foundations which laid the program from 2005 to 2008 did not include NGOs.
Thank you very much indeed. And before I give the floor to Mr. Dr. Busuttil, I can tell that with the enlargement we have learned to pronounce Niepokolszycka from Poland, and we have learned to pronounce Alwita Almanalicjene. So I can promise you that your name is much more easier. Please, what is your comments to our discussion?
Mr. President, and let me start by saying that at your second attempt you managed to get my name quite right. I would like to start by expressing my pleasure to be here, and also by congratulating the ESC for its work and thanking it also for its work, notably the President, Frau Sigmund, and also yourself as President of Group 3, Mr. Chairman. So my first point is thank you to the ESC for its work. I think that your contribution is there, is valid, and is certainly important. It is also appreciated. I came here to listen, but all politicians say that they want to listen and then eventually just grab the microphone and speak. So I suppose that I have to follow also in that tradition. I must say, as my first point, that I think it's very important for the ESC to raise its profile. I do not think that the profile of the ESC is sufficiently high with the man in the street. Of course, you are doing a great job, but do the people know that you're doing a great job? And I think the answer to that question is yes. So certainly, as an organ of the European Union, as one of the official organs of the European Union, you certainly need to work on raising your profile and raising awareness on the ESC. I think that that can also be done in cooperation with the European Parliament. After all, we are also representatives of society, and we already cooperate a great deal with the ESC and even with individual organizations and members of the ESC. I, for one, for instance, am a member of the Budgets Committee of the European Parliament and also a substitute member of the Regional Development Committee. And in this capacity, I have a regular influx of lobbying meetings and lobbying requests by members of the ESC, which I gladly accept. So I think this cooperation already exists and needs to continue. And this brings me to the main point of my intervention. I think that we need to work on bridging the gap between the EU and the citizens. But this is not only the job of the Commission. This is not only the job of the EU. nor is it only the job of national governments, although I clearly agree with the point made earlier that national governments more often than not tend to blame Brussels, point an accusing finger at Brussels when something goes wrong, and then claim all the credit when something goes right. But clearly this is not a responsibility. This, this task of bridging the gap between the European Union and the citizens is not just the responsibility of the Commission, it's not just the responsibility of national governments, it's our responsibility, all of us, at different levels. Clearly a responsibility for members of the European Parliament, clearly also a responsibility for members of the EESC. I think that it is important that at all levels, people in our position make a great effort to bridge this gap. After all, if we truly believe that the European Union does give an added value in Europe, if we truly believe that it does improve the day-to-day life of European citizens, then the least we can do is explain to the people how this is happening. I will conclude by sharing with you an experience I've had only last week, earlier this week actually, when I was on my way to Brussels, and as soon as we got off the plane and were making our way to the exit, I met a person, a Maltese person, who was in Brussels for the first time, and he asked me to help him to make it to the exit. And I told him, well, there is the exit, there is that sign, the blue sign, which says EU, and actually there was also another blue sign which says no EU. I told him, you have to go through that channel. And as we walked by, he pointed to the second sign, no EU, and he told me, is this where the French and the Dutch pass from? And I think, I think it was an extremely witty comment that should tell us a lot, that people do understand if only we had the patience to explain to them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. And Mrs. Borsch.
Basically, I just want to clarify some points made by the previous speaker about motherhood and about the younger generation. I would like to make it clear that National Council of Women never undermined the role of motherhood. What I was saying in my presentation is that we should maybe enhance the role of fatherhood. It doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It's a matter of just doing things together. And regarding the young and the old debate, I mean, we're all young and we're all going to be old. So what if today I'm struggling and commenting about let's give the opportunity to the younger ones, in the future I'm going to be old myself, so even I myself want to protect the older generation. So the debate should be more how we're going to be working together rather than who is going to be given what. And you know, a proof of this is in the National Council of Women itself. I take pride to say that we have, in fact, we even have a committee which is made up of youngsters, and we have the older people with a lot of experience helping us, and we help them. So that should be the way forward. It's not a matter of, you know, it's not a war. It's a matter of working together, because we're all going to, we were all young and we're all going to be old one day, just to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I have five speakers more from the list of the European, from the group three. And I ask you to be rather brief, because I think we in some minutes should come to sum up and give the floor back to Mrs. Sigmund for some end comments. But first, Mr. Stulik.
Thank you for putting us at the end of the list, because we are here just to listen to what our colleagues from Malta think about these things. So I will try to be brief, because there are many issues, thought-provoking issues, which Frau Sigmund mentioned in her speech, and I think we should reflect them when we are back in Brussels during our meetings, because I think they really deserve more in-depth debates. For example, I'm very much appreciated to mention that there are also qualitative criteria of representativity, and I would like to add a few more thoughts to it, because we in Prague at the Charles University, you know, focus a lot of attention on these criteria, so I would like to come back to it maybe in Brussels, not to have kind of an internal debates here in front of our colleagues who are not involved in them. But anyway, I would like to say a few words about, for example, the issue of blaming Brussels for something and taking credits as a national government for the positive things And here I think that the Maltese member of the Parliament, European Parliament, said, it's a task for everybody here. And we already have several positive success stories when civil society organizations were able to clarify the situation about some things when the government was blaming the Brussels for wrongdoing. And this is the task for the civil society. And maybe that's one of the possible roles which our committee can play. And also our foundation, which is involved in administrating European Social Fund in the Czech Republic, managed to clarify some interpretation of the government of certain EU regulations. And that was the case when the EU was perceived then by civil society in a negative way. And we managed to clarify that it's actually the problem of the Czech authorities, not of Brussels. That was the problem of Czech authorities, how they interpret these EU regulations. But they tried to interpret it into their own positive kind of a way. So that's the task for the civil society as well. The other thing which I wanted to say here is related to the debate how the constitution, EU constitutional treaty, was carried on. I think that one of the reasons why these two countries also refused, maybe it was more than the case in the Netherlands, was how the debate was carried on and how it was handled. Because my impression was that we were facing the situation, there is only one good, positive solution to accept the treaty. Other alternatives were not taken into account, and there was a kind of this logic, who is against this treaty is against the EU. And even people who had some constructive criticism of this treaty were immediately labeled with a label of Eurosceptics, and their points of view were not taken into account. And I must say it was also my situation, because I have had several reservations to this treaty, and immediately I was blamed to be Eurosceptic. If this debate is carried on in that way, I'm forgetting about the content, and I'm just voting against the way how this debate is carried on. And I think that's very positive that now we are forced to have more reflection of these issues, because I do believe there is still a chance to have another treaty which can be called constitution, which can be simpler, which can be more comprehensive to people, and which can form a basis for sharing some values, which will be, you know, clear to everybody. As somebody said, that every child in the United States knows almost by heart the beginning of the US Constitution. So that would be something which we are still, you know, striving for. And I think it's achievable, it's possible, but these kind of debates, constitution-making debates, take time, and they need to have societies be ready for that. And I don't think that we were in the moment when the societies were prepared to accept this constitution, so that's why we still need to carry on these debates and be open also to the other points of views which might not be in line with the official, you know, interpretation coming from the Commission or coming from the authorities. So I would be very much happy to see the space open to different points of views, because then we can have a kind of an open debate and seeing clearly the pros and cons of different, you know, sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. And I give the floor to Daniel Lescorni.
Yes, I'd like to stress the ambition of the committee, stress the ambition of the president of the committee, and also her creativity. We need to do something to introduce something new here, civil society dialogue. Of course, we mustn't confuse this with the social dialogue, and this mustn't be reduce it to that. This is well organized now. But we do have a serious problem here. I listened to the Member of Parliament who said that we can cooperate together. But there's cooperation, there's also the question of the relationship of different forces and strengths. Parliamentarians think that they're legitimate representatives of society. Both sides of industry consider that they're the most legitimate representatives of our populations. Our own organizations often act more as lobbyists, and they're not prepared to give up their positions to the lobbyists. So I think that we mustn't expect full understanding from the outside world. I think we need to do a lot in the Economic and Social Committee. We need to do something to increase our own authority. if you ask anyone in France who knows the Economic and Social Committee, who is aware of this, the answer is nobody. And why is nobody aware of this? Well, simply because none of us appears to the population as a member of the Economic and Social Committee. We don't put over the position of our committee. Often we reduce our position to that of our own organization. We saw this in connection with the European Constitutional Treaty. I made a lot of effort in France to ensure that all the French councillors in the European Economic and Social Committee should have the same position. And we should make it known to our population that the committee, with a very large majority, had given its approval to the Constitutional Treaty, whereas the member organizations were opposed to it. This is a contradiction we have to take on board. We have to accept it. Of course, there are problems here. First of all, I think that the committee needs to find some way of giving clearer instructions to its members for the purpose of representing the committee in each country. I don't think we've done enough there. And then there's the problem of the status of the members of the committee. They depend on their organizations, and often there are conflicts of interest between the position of the committee and the position of one's own organization. And all this, I think, needs to be dealt with in a very tough manner. And of course, we can't leave this in the hands of the president alone. We have a certain responsibility as councillors in our own countries. It's true for the members of parliament as well. The debate in France was undertaken by members of national political parties on a nationalist basis. And we didn't really hear much from the members of the committee, depending on the European position. So we do have individual responsibility, a personal responsibility. We have a function of our own that we should play to the full, even when we are sometimes in contradiction with our own organizations or our own parties. We have to say, well, we represent the European Economic and Social Committee. We have certain positions, and I think we have to recognize this. We talk about diversity, but there's also the question of unity. We are a fully-fledged organization with a position of its own, a unique position, which I think has to be made known, discussed, so we need to make an effort there. And I think that the new members have a greater chance of doing this successfully than the older countries. We have long traditions in our countries of national representativity, basically. And I think it's very important that the new members should deal with the institutions on the same footing. There shouldn't be a kind of hierarchy of our institutions. In other words, Commission, Parliament, Council, Commission, Parliament, and finally the Economic and Social Committee. Not at all. I think that each of these institutions has its own legitimate position, and we have a right to talk about Europe.
We have some more speakers on the list, but I ask you to be rather brief because we need to give our president the word back in reflections. Mr. Henrik Danusevich. Mrs. Attard, did you ask for the floor?
I'll be brief, but some reflections on the presentation of Madam President, which I think is very important, and it was an excellent and challenging presentation. The question of defining organized civil society. We're using the term civil society. I don't think all of us agree with the meaning of civil society. For example, in Malta, sometimes we use civil society meaning employers' associations, unions, and varied interest groups. Other times, we refer to it as varied interest groups only. So definitely, we need to clarify what we mean when we say civil society. Madam President highlighted important criteria for non-governmental organizations: transparency, accountability, independence, a democratic basis, a legal framework, which we are working on in Malta, and unfortunately the white paper is causing deep concerns because we feel that a distinction has to be made in the question of independence. For example, how can we have the equivalent of the ESC, which we call the Malta Economic and Social Development, with a subcommittee of a limited number of our organizations that are NGOs, together with government commissions? I mean, for me, that is heresy to have within a civil society organization a number of government commissions. It is something that we are working on at present through the MCSD. again, for example, I am here, or I am a member of the ESC, because I belong to the Civil Society MCSD Committee. I mean, what about all the other NGOs? Don't they, too, have a say in nominating a person to represent them? Don't I have the duty also to report to them and not report only to the 8 organizations that belong to the MCSD? I think that's very important also. Again, when we talk about NGOs, what do we mean exactly? There are so many classifications. There are, for example, non-governmental organizations that cater for their members only. There are others that are umbrella organizations. That is, they comprise a number like 27, 28 or more organizations. There are others that work for a sector of society, not just a few members or a good number of members that are their own members representing their own organization only. So when we're talking about criteria, I think that there are several ways of dealing with it. It's not going to be an easy situation. I think government should give space to non-governmental organizations. How that is to come about depends on us NGOs contributing to the national debates. It depends on the structures that government offers to different sections of NGOs to be able to participate. It is not enough to say we want to participate. Unless we are in the consultation process, we cannot really participate. I conclude with something that doesn't have to do directly with ESC, but we have referred to the European parliamentarians. We have 5 in Malta. We refer to the ESC members, and there are only 5, so you can imagine how we can really represent and work in all areas when we are only 5 members. And we mustn't forget, in the whole setup of the EU, the Committee of Regions also, and perhaps even the need to network with the Committee of Regions. We tend to work separately even with the Committee of Regions. Thank you.
We have 2 more brief speakers. First, Sehr geehrten Herrn Kletzmeier from the Alpinian area.
Thank you. I've got to forget everything that I've written down here to say to everyone. There are just 3 points instead that I want to stress. Mr. Stephens raised a question. He asked if a legal basis for parts of civil society was perhaps not a little bit old-fashioned, sort of code. In Europe, we had an ideological system said that everything that existed between the state level and the individual should be scrapped. Now, without wanting to make incorrect comparisons, everything between formal democracy and individuals, scrapping all of that bears the risk of a new totalitarianism. If we haven't got a common vision of what the state is to do, it's difficult. We're talking about it more as a technical construction, and having nothing between that and the individual is highly risky. Mrs. Ellen from Ireland, and this is my second point, said that the EU is not the constitutional treaty or other technical matters. The basis of the EU is a common vision. That's a very core statement. And I think that that's something which we should appreciate for ourselves before we start making criticism of individual technical elements. Thirdly, several representatives have said that individuals, men and women, are a source of happiness. Perhaps I could put this in more modern terms. They are sources of relations. The objective of Europe can only be to create this sort of relationships between individuals rather than just increasing GDP. If you look at the newspapers, if you see that the final objective of the EU is to maximise individual incomes, and if you see that the market is meant to be there as the instrument to distribute income, then you're saying that the state cannot intervene in that process and make, for example, corrections, then here in this sort of body, that is something we should be thinking about in particular. The joint vision, as has been said, should not be to create individuals who have high incomes for themselves. That should not be the aim of the EU. That is important for us to bear in mind. Thank you.
Mrs. Albita Armanovic.
I will be very briefly, because of my very bad English and maybe a very complex family name. And our colleague from Parliament said that our members countries could promote civil society. But we see that that process is very difficult. Why? And, for example, in EU level, EU institutions should see that real monitors of implementation of all directives are really organizations, civil society organizations, as watchdogs, not member states authorities, because they have, especially having small markets, they are, have very, very individual interests. And why in various policy documents from the Commission you clearly not declaring that NGOs are really monitors of all EU legislation? You should see us as really friends, but not ministers and so on. And from what our committee could start to propose to Commission to elaborate, to prepare recommendation for member states, for recognition for organizations. Because if consumer organization is dependent organization, so is cheaters organization, but not consumer organization. And our governmentals, in especially new countries, they playing democracy and involving their own newly established friendly organizations only playing democracy. It's not true and false process.
Thank you very much. And I think we have come on to an end. Before I give the floor back to Anne-Marie, I will say that I have given this discussion more space. I can see that you have had much more, you have had a very high level of you wanted to participate in. So the last part we will cut off a little. And before I give the floor, I will say we have planned to have a coffee break. We have only 1 hour still left, and we need at least 30-40 minutes for the last part. I know that Michael Ferry, you have a very suitable name for to be in an island. But you want to have some contribution before I give the floor back to Anne-Marie Sigmund. Please, Michael Ferry.
Thank you, Mr. President of Group 3. Just 2 minutes, because the coffee is out. Way back to November of 2004, Madame Sigmund came over to the President's and Secretary General meeting of the European Economic and Social Councils in Luxembourg, and she was invited to attend the launching of the President's and Secretary General's Declaration on how to improve the implementation of the Lisbon Strategy, a document that was finally sent to the Council of Heads of Government and the State for the meeting in March 2005, and following which the European Economic and Social Committee was encouraged to build bridges with civil society and the European Union Economic and Social Councils to speed up the process of implementing the Lisbon Strategy. My reflection is this: after 5 years of talking about the Lisbon Strategy, I think it's high time that we have the courage and the will to put aside a bit Lisbon. Now we have the national reform programs. Every country is drawing up its NRP. This will be presented to the EU Commission. Following that, the EU Commission will start monitoring what's going on during the next 3 years. And so the process now is put in place, basically. We don't need any more discussing Lisbon. And I come back to the point of mentioning Madame Sigmund in Luxembourg, November 2004. When she was there, she made a great emphasis on the importance of communicating Europe. And I think that the most important thing at this point in time, in my opinion, for the European Economic and Social Committee is to communicate Europe. People know that the Lisbon strategy has failed. People are aware that we didn't manage to achieve the targets. People know that there are the NRPs now to try and to make up for lost time and lost energies and lost resources and resources that we didn't manage to use properly, etc. So one of the questions Madam Sigmund asked during her intervention this afternoon was, who is going to talk to whom and who will do what? And I add a little question. What feedback are we expecting from the grassroots, from the men in the street, from civil society? And we had said way back to March 2000, when the Lisbon strategy was launched, that we need to start acting. The Prime Minister and Heads of State repeated this again last March. We need to start acting. But we need to start acting not on the Lisbon strategy any longer. We need to start acting on communicating Europe. And I think we have an opportunity with Madam Sigmund's talents, I would say, to strike the required deal with Vice President Margrethe Wallström, to involve ourselves both as EESC and as European Economic and Social Councils, together with all those organizations who are ready to participate in this initiative, to create the required strategy to start communicating Europe. I think this is the mission that we have. It seems that the mission up to now was the Lisbon strategy, but in my opinion, the mission is, let us communicate Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And Anne-Marie, we have not so much time, but perhaps you want to make some few remarks. Wait and see. Please, Anne-Marie, take the floor. Well, you have had a lot of comments, and of course I understand that you want to make comments to the interventions.
Thank you, Stefan. I'll try and be brief, even though I'm very tempted indeed to go into more detail on this, because this is an area where I think that the key subjects come up. I'm sure that we could talk about questions of economics and figures, etc., until the cows come home. But until we can get some basic consensus on certain issues, then obviously that won't take us very far. Just to summarise a few things, Mr. Kalembi-Sattar asked what civil society is. In my opinion for 1999, I had some help from a colleague from the EESC, and I defined it, so I'd like to send you copies of that. It's important to stress that, as far as we're concerned, the social partners are the core of this civil society, and that there are other formations which have placed themselves around the social partners, and that's why the social partners have a very important place in social dialogue. But that does not detract from that role either. But I think that is important for the Commission to address, so we can move forward. When it comes to NGOs, there is a question of recognition for NGOs, the possibility of giving them more status. An NGO, well, NGO is just a description for an organisation. It doesn't say anything about what it does. I don't like that term at all. I don't say that I'm not a man, I say I am a woman. So I don't like this idea of saying what you aren't, distancing yourself from the state, for example. We've got to say what we are. I mean, if you take that term and then say we work together with other organisations, it's just too difficult. We're going to discuss all of these sorts of subjects. We're going to have to find ways of holding discussion more often, without actually fixing the subjects which have to be discussed. We have to be more flexible about that. So that's important. Professor Steffen, you were asking about mandatory membership, and I think that you asked me that question with good reason. I've seen that. Our view is that we shouldn't be talking about enforced membership, we should be talking about a duty of membership. If there's a duty of membership, then I think there are reasons for it. It's something which happens in the common interest. Bring me back to the liberal professions. I mean, if you have someone who wishes to leave, for example, the Chamber of Doctors, well, it's difficult to enforce the rules which that person would have to apply in professional life. It's very difficult in this sort of cases to work on a voluntary basis. There are certain professional branches, certain areas in community where a duty of membership does make sense. When it comes to financial dependence and independence, well, I think wherever we can, we need to stress the fact that the public authorities have the right to stress certain things, but that rights cannot be derived from this. So it is an action which does not create rights, if you like. What about membership of the European Parliament? The European Parliament has many functions, including budgetary functions. It looks exactly at how we spend our money, but it doesn't actually interfere with the work which we do, and that is the right way to do this. So the Parliament is carrying out a task in the public interest, but allows us a free hand to carry out our work. Then we had a question which came up a couple of times, talking about the image of the EU and saying that all of the good things that happen come from member states and everything which is bad comes from Brussels. Well, here you have to remember that the way politicians think is in fairly short periods of time, i.e. durations of parliaments. MPs want to be re-elected. It happens in my country as well. And sometimes, because they think of their next election, then they say things which aren't quite correct. They say that decisions have been taken in Brussels, but they don't tell the whole truth. They don't say that it's the Council of Ministers in Brussels which takes the final decision, and that that is the Member States body. One thing which hasn't been discussed sufficiently is the question of the media. What happens in Austria when we're talking about stirring up public opinion against the media? The EU is that our media come into play. We've got a small newspaper in Austria which has said that the EU is forbidding waitresses in certain pubs to wear tops with very deep cut nets, for example, and that's absolute rubbish. It is something which actually has come up. It is something which the Commission has put on the table, but it's there to protect people against, for example, exposure to the sun. They could quite easily have taken as an example of this a builder with a bald head and shown that instead of the waitress. I mean, this is the way in which this sort of thing is not portrayed correctly. I mean, all of these things happen, but the thing is that we have to correct the sort of pictures. We've got to get the media on board to work in favour of the EU. We've got to say that it should not be considered shameful to work for the future of the EU. If I think of the place where I'm going to retire to in Austria, it's a small village with 701 inhabitants. It was very difficult for me going down to that village. Firstly, people thought that I was just a town person, and then they realised I work in Brussels, and now they've been against me because I work in Brussels. And we have to work against this sort of poor image of the EU. I was very pleased what was said by the representative of the EP. I'd like to meet up with you because I think there's a lot which we can do together. There is no tug of war between the EP and the DESC. We are both there to represent citizens, to participate in the legislative procedure. You're there to produce the legislation, and we are there to provide expertise, but we don't actually take decisions, so we do complement one another, and there's no need, therefore, for a tug of war. Now, I've tried to cooperate with the different institutions, but unfortunately, I have to say quite openly, we've given up the idea of cooperating with the Committee of the Regions. They just don't want that. I won't explain why. But the European Parliament is a different kettle of fish. There's a parliamentary approach to this. I met with the heads of chairman of the committees in the Parliament recently. We've had good contacts with them. The President of Parliament is always in contact with us, and I'm sure that we can work together for the future of Europe. I mean, we're not just talking about grand declarations with signatures at the bottom. We're talking about small steps together. Malhelm, what you said on Jeremy Rifkin was correct. I was sad for me to read what he was saying about the Constitution. Joseph Weiler's written a book as well. He's a Jew who lives in the United States, and he was talking about the Constitution and made a lot of very good points, for example, on the preamble. So a lot of this has to be looked at by us, because that's how we're seen from the outside. When it comes to the constitutional treaty, perhaps you'll be shocked to hear this, but my view is that if we were to ask ordinary citizens in the street what their view of the constitutional treaty is, then we'd be asking too much of them. We've got representative democracy, and in that sort of democracy we have elected representatives who should be taking those decisions on our behalf. Ask anyone in any country what's in that country's constitution, then I'm sure that they would have difficulties explaining that to you. I'm sure that I couldn't find many Austrians who know too much about the Austrian constitution itself. But then, really, we are posing them this challenge of taking a decision of this type which applies across the board. Now, Austria is very much against atomic power, and that was a subject of a referendum. Should we be developing it or moving away from atomic power? Now, the result was a clear no, because Bundeskanzler Kreisky had wanted to get his own way over the argument. He wanted to say no, and in his campaign he went for the no vote without actually talking about the content, and that is what he achieved. And that seems to be the same sort of thing as we've seen with the constitutional treaty as well. One lady said that we are afraid of older people. I don't think so. I'm a little bit old myself. I don't think people are afraid of me because I'm old, but because sometimes I can be a little bit grumpy, a bit difficult to deal with. Dr. Borsch gave us some clear ideas about how we can have solidarity between the generations, not just between men and women, but how to bring different groups together in that way. A lady called Claudia, I didn't understand your surname, but there was a question about legal identity. Now, that was obviously a legal question. We do need to have, however, some legal basis for actions. There are different laws on associations in different countries, and I think that what we've got to look at is the status of NGOs at the European level. We've been talking about European level associations and their statutes for 20 years now, and we haven't made progress on that. There have been problems, including tax-related problems. Makes suggestions as regards who they wish to appoint as members to the EESC. So it's really a question for national governments. I mean, you may be just five people from your country, but Luxembourg just has three members of the EESC. But it's not the quantity that's important, it's how those members act. So Malta is still in a better position than Luxembourg, 5-3 members. Mr. Sturik, on representativeness, I'd love to have a discussion of that with you. I think that there are some important inroads that we can take on board there. Your message is that we need to be optimistic, not just say, well, there's no possibility of things working out, but we should be more optimistic. As I said at the beginning, we should stop talking about crises, we should talk about challenges, and that's something which should be applied to all of us here, the ESC, the Parliament, etc. I think that it's important for those people who think it's worth it for Europe to participate in the process here through the different organisations. Michael Ferry gave us a good summary. What I think is significant is that we should concentrate on communicating Europe. One of the main points of my work programme deals with communication, but it's also something which Mrs. Wallström, one of the Commission's Vice Presidents, is responsible for. She's currently drawing up a white paper on this. Her problem is that she has not yet got any specific inroads into the subject. We've said that we're going to be holding the stakeholder forum on the 7th and 8th of November. The President of Group 3 has already addressed a letter to the members of his group asking for organisations to be named, organisations which should be invited to the forum to be named. We're talking about organisations which haven't yet had an opportunity to get their voices heard. Not just organisations, but individuals could be invited as well. People who would be prepared to come to Brussels for 2 days to this very, very tiring discussion, but who wish to make a contribution to it. Because the success of the event really is dependent upon the willingness of participants to spend such a long time sitting and discussing this subject. I've been to this sort of event myself in the past. They are very tiring indeed, but they are very good because they give us something specific to take away with us and work on. What about sustainability? This is something which we've discussed in this sort of way in the past. It's a term which has been used by many just in the area of the environment, but it can also be seen far more broadly. That's the sort of thing I'm talking about. If you know of individuals that might be able to help us, then please let us know who they are. It would be very good indeed, if not just more Maltese members, but members from the rest of Europe could return home today and see whether, and think about whether this sort of event could be held in their member state as well. It's important for me for the first event of this type to be held in Brussels. Once the white paper has been tabled by Mrs. Wallström, I think it's very important for us to have these events in all the member states so that we can contribute to this as well. I think that it would be a very good opportunity for us to come back together once again.
Campus FM has just presented excerpts from the extraordinary meeting of the Group 3 Bureau of the European Economic and Social Committee. The meeting was titled The Role and Involvement of Various Civil Society Players in Achieving a Balance Between the Three Pillars of the Lisbon Strategy.